The vocation we have chosen is a veil of tears.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. But...
Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today with us is J. Robert Lennon. J. Robert Lennon is the author of 8 previous novels, including Broken River and Familiar, and 3 story collections, Let Me Think, Pieces for the Left Hand, and See You in Paradise. He lives in Ithaca, New York. John, welcome.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for being here, John.
Thank you, Lindsay. I'm really excited about it.
Yay.
I love the podcast, and I love you guys, and I'm very, very glad we could have this conversation.
I'm so glad that we can tell you that we love you and we can be open about that.
We love you, bud.
We love you too. What are you going to read to us?
Well, I started in the fall of 2019 what I thought was a short story. Someone had asked me to, a guy I knew was guest editing an issue of Granta and asked me for a story. And this, and the subject was membranes.
Oh.
And which I think was a really good topic, but it's one of those things where it could mean nothing or it can mean everything. And I had an idea for something. So I started writing what I thought was going to be a short story. And it was eventually published in Granta, but seeing it in the page proofs, it was just very obvious that it was actually the first chapter of a novel. So
how often does that happen to you?
Never.
Really?
Well, no, that's not true. It happened once. My novel Mailman started out as a short story.
Mm.
But actually somebody asked me, I said yes to this, but for the AWP that's going to be in Philadelphia next year, if I would like to be on a panel where they talk about this supposed problem of how do you know whether what you're writing is a flash piece or a short story or a novella or a novel or a series of novels, you know? And, I said, sure, that would be great. And it will probably be a good conversation, but I have to admit it's not a real problem for me. It's like, I usually know exactly what I'm writing. I might not finish it or I might be bad, but I know what it's supposed to be. But this time I did not. So anyway, I started writing it as a novel and then I had to edit the books that have now come out and that I think we'll be talking about later. And then the pandemic started and I had to learn to teach online and then a bunch of stuff happened. And I keep going back to it. But now, finally, literally today, I opened up the file for the first time in months and I'm going to be working on it through to September. And because I just finished a book review I'd been assigned. So I'm freed up. I cleared off my computer desktop and this is something I have that I wrote and I have not read since I wrote it. And all it is I will say that it was a deeply satisfying writing session. I don't know if it's going to be a deeply satisfying reading session for anyone. But all it is a highly technical description of a tower.
Perfect.
that this guy, he's alone on an island employed by some mysterious agency, and he's been asked to repair a broken part of the tower. So, and I just grooved so hard on just describing this object, this complicated object. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Okay, you ready?
We're ready. Awesome.
All right. The plinth on which the towers stood was almost uncanny in its regularity. Precisely level and smooth, it seemed in stony communion with the featureless sea beyond. No safety railing protected me from a fall to the rocks below. I had to be careful. The 3 towers close up were immense. Each stood upon a massive circular slab of 3-inch thick steel, at least 20 feet in diameter, which was fastened to the concrete, and probably the bedrock beneath it, by bolts whose heads were the size of automobile tires. From each slab rose 3 posts of tubular steel connected to each other by a lattice of smaller tubes. The towers narrowed as they rose, presumably to points at the top, but my view of each apex was obstructed by a superstructure of hardware. Flat panels, parabolic dishes, drum-like microwave antennae, and other protrusions and extensions of uncertain purpose surrounded by catwalks and ladders. Each tower was also helixed by a narrow steel staircase, one of which I would doubtless soon be climbing, and dotted with steel guy plates whose stout wires were anchored to the stony hillside and cement platform, as well as, judging by the ones that plunged into the surf, to the seafloor. It was a relief to see the narrow access stairs. I'd feared I would have to climb a ladder to the top. My concern over identifying the ailing tower also appeared misplaced. A giant black numeral, tall as a man, had been painted on the concrete beside each base plate. Tower 1, I could see now, was the farthest from me, occupying the opposite corner of the platform. My breath formed clouds in the cold air as I strode over to it. Gazing up at the tower from the bottom of the stairs induced vertigo. I swooned and gripped the handrail. Reassured by its solidity, I began my climb. I suppose I'd been expecting an effortful journey to the top, but I was surprised at how long it took and how many times I had to stop for a rest. At what I judged to be the halfway point, I arrived at a box-like enclosure built into the area bounded by the three posts. Its steel sides were interrupted by small windows of thick, wire-reinforced glass and a narrow door bearing a small lever. I expected the door to be locked, then laughed at myself when it opened easily. Of course, there was no need to lock a door so remote and difficult to access. The door admitted me into a small, triangular room that contained a small steel bench and a wall-mounted utility access panel. Opening the panel revealed a snarl of thick, colored wires patched together via multiple distribution blocks, an electrical and data junction. Electrical work was not my area of expertise, but nothing here looked amiss to me. No obvious disconnects, no discoloration or damage to suggest a short. Of course, if Assistant Director Blythe was to be believed, the wiring was not likely to be the problem. I exited the junction room and continued my climb. I could see down onto the roof of headquarters and was mildly surprised to see that someone had left a chair and small table up there. I hadn't realized it was even possible to reach the roof and made a mental note to do so when the weather was more clement. Perhaps my predecessor visited every now and then to ponder life and take in the scenery. Whatever view he'd enjoyed, though, couldn't compare to the one I beheld now. The towers offered an extraordinary view of the island, its peaks and ridge, the beach and plain, the pier, and the ruins of the village. From here it was possible to discern the ghostly, rough-hewn grid of former streets and footpaths that I had previously seen via the control room's display temporal adjustment knob. The most noteworthy feature of this vantage, however, wasn't the island itself, but the vastness and emptiness of the surrounding ocean. I had understood that the island was remote, of course, but only now did I appreciate its profound isolation from the world. In every direction, as far as the eye could see, the water extended to the horizon, undisturbed by any landmass or ocean-going vessel. Sunlight glinted on the waves, but they were so distant as to be indistinguishable. The sea appeared as calm and monolithic as a slab of dark glass. My solitude, always palpable, now felt profound, and for the first time, I doubted the possibility that I might ever meet another human being again. I'll stop there.
John, did you write that today?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No. No, this is right near the end of what I wrote
before.
Several months ago.
Okay.
Before the semester began.
Wow. It is so realized, and it is so clear, like the details are so clear, and they are so they're so fun to listen to, and I bet they were really fun to say,
like, yes, the way they were that, fun to say.
Yes, like the way those words clear. Yes.
Well, I will say, if I could get complete satisfaction out of writing, and other people could get complete satisfaction out of reading just descriptions of spaces and objects, that is all I would write. It's like, when I realized what I was going to have to do, I opened like six or seven tabs. I downloaded tons of photos. So I
was going to ask you that.
Like,
yes.
Every part of a radio tower is called. Mm-hmm. And then of course there's impossible technology that you, like the temporal adjustment knob, is not a real thing. but it is in this book. So I had to invent things that looked wouldn't seem out of place on a real radio tower, but that corresponded to weird technology. There's more, you know, there's more of it later as he does repair the broken thing. It turns out a bird died in it.
Mm.
And there's a little, he has a little moment of bonding with the spirit of the bird. But, the couple of days I spent just meticulously creating this imaginary object was so satisfying.
Oh my gosh. I want to I feel like I did see it. I feel like I was watching a series of images.
Okay, good.
But now I really want to see it.
If only emotional content were not necessary.
I know, right?
For you to care about this tower.
Hear, hear.
John, was your way into Subdivision a similar process? Although, you know, the world of Subdivision may not be as technical, there definitely is very specific language and, you know, it's a very specific world. Was it a similar kind of wanting to be in that space, wanting to take the reader into that space and then just exist in that world for a while?
Yeah, for sure. Where this book came from, where Subdivision came from, was I was giving a reading somewhere near Rochester at a college, and they put me up in a bed and breakfast that was run by two retired women. Mm. One of them had been a judge and the other had been a nun. In Subdivision, I made them both judges and gave them the same name to be a dick, I guess. but the true thing that's in the book is that they had a room that was dominated by a big dining table that was covered by a partially solved puzzle, like the biggest cardboard puzzle I'd ever seen. And they very eagerly said to me, before I'd even put my bags down, "You can come downstairs anytime and work on the puzzle."
I can't believe that's the real part. I mean,
isn't that crazy?
I thought you were going to say there was this accident and I vibed off of that for a while.
Luckily there was no real accident. It was the puzzle. And, I found this hilarious. I emailed, I can't remember who it was, but I emailed a friend about this, and it's basically the first line of the book is what I said to them. And the response was, "That sounds like the beginning of a novel." I was like, "God, yes, it does. It sounds like the beginning of a novel by me, in fact." Yeah. So this idea, I really like, one of my hobbies is photography. I like to go to a new place and just stalk around with the camera and document its ordinariness and like different iterations of ordinariness in different places is for some reason very fun and satisfying to me. So I didn't know what this novel was going to be about, but I gave the narrator amnesia and had the ladies give her a map of the town and just set her loose to see what would happen. And very quickly I had an idea of what was going on and I went from there. But I really do like trying to bring an anomalous space or object to life. It's very fun.
Mm-hmm. There still is that technical language, though, that then very specific language. I mean, Weedy Verge will be in my head forever now. It's, you know, I'd never encountered that. And then I read it and I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I've grown up around those and I did not recognize them as such. So there's definitely still a lot of that in there in a wonderful way.
There's a thing in there. When I was writing this book, I had a note on my phone that I would just add everything that seemed interesting to me in the couple of years I was pondering it and preparing to write it and then finally writing it. I just threw it in there, even if it didn't seem to be important. And one of them was, I was like driving home one night and came across one of those, you know, those things, it's like a traffic cone, except it's big. It's more like a barrel. Mm-hmm. And it has like this crazy reflective pattern on it that almost doesn't seem real. It's so weird. And I can't remember. I didn't put the name of it in the book, but it's.
But they're in the book on the way to the city, right?
They're in there.
On the road to the city.
As I passed it, it was like, it seemed like this object that was a kind of ghost almost. And, you know, there was some like caution tape fluttering around and there was some dirt on the ground. And I was like, why is that so? Why do I find that so beautiful? And I think it's just because it was so specific. It was just this little collection of prosaic objects that somehow felt meaningful. And yeah. if you're a novelist, of course, you can actually make it meaningful.
Do you often do that? Do you often ponder something you know that you're eventually going to write for a while before you sit down to actually write it?
Sometimes. I wrote Subdivision really fast, the first draft, like 4 months. Wow. But I had thought about it for a while. I wrote like what I wrote the first 10 or 15 pages and then set them aside and did other stuff for a year or so. And that's when I gathered notes and ideas for it. Once I realized maybe there's a novel here, but what is it going to be about? And I just thought of all the stuff that I was obsessed with and bundled it in there. So short fiction, I never do that. I just get an idea and I go for it. And maybe a third of the time I finish. And if I don't, I'm probably never going to go back. But sometimes I do.
Do you write a story all at once?
Usually over a few days. Yeah. First draft of a story. Not always. Sometimes it takes a while and I add just a little bit each day. But the usual thing is I just get it like an attack.
Yeah.
And just go for it. And get a really rough, fast draft in a few days.
Yeah. Do you find that you lose momentum if you have to put it away for a little longer?
Yeah.
Yeah. That I can totally relate to that. And I thought I was a hack.
Yeah. I was really into, like, just a few weeks ago, I started writing a story about an old guy and his daughter and his granddaughter and the three of them living together and having lost a couple family members to COVID, and it's still the pandemic, and the daughter, the granddaughter and the grandfather are hanging out together in a video game.
Oh, wow.
And that's all they do all day. And the mom doesn't understand them. And I was so on it. Like, I was like, this is it. This is my next big story. And then like, I went away for the weekend and I came back and I was like, eh. So now it's like, I'm trying to I might never get the feeling back. I don't think it was because I went away for the weekend. I think I came to a stopping point and it was like, oh, I'll just pick it up when I get back. But I think the stopping point was the problem. I think that I didn't actually have an idea. I just had a situation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So John,
oh no, go ahead.
No, you keep going.
Nope. It was just going to be a personal anecdote.
Yeah, but I love those.
Yeah, please. No, let's hear the personal anecdote.
100%.
Nope. Now, you know what? I went away for the weekend, so it's gone.
Oh, I hate you.
That's really not cool.
She's brutal.
Cool.
So after the initial 10 or 15 pages that you get down for Subdivision, you're gathering all this wonderful detail on your phone, you know, taking time with it. When you actually sit down to begin drafting, are you just following sentence, paragraph by paragraph, kind of following yourself, you know, just where the story may take you, or how much of this was outlined before? I'm just so curious about, like, on a granular level, how this novel was drafted.
At the beginning of my career, I outlined obsessively.
Okay.
I think because I hadn't done it before and I wanted to sit down each day and have a list of tasks to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the older I've gotten, the less I do that. And now I do literally nothing of that. I just sort of go for it off the top of my head every day. And it's not really off the top of my head because I've been living with my notes and the details. And as I move forward, I sort of think, oh, I guess I'll want her to go to this place. She's going to have to explore that. It's very much like when you, in a video game, when you find the beginning of like 8 quests and you just get to decide which quest you want to go on next time you play, in your quest list, I kind of have a mental list of this stuff has to happen at some point. Which one should I do next? So it's a bit of a mental outline, and then, you know, I just consult my list of ideas and think, oh, I'm going to get that item in there. I want to get this concept in there. Once I realize what the backstory was, that there's a sort of tragic, a sort of mysterious tragic circumstance that brought the narrator to this place.
Right.
That gave me this opportunity to bring elements of it into the novel disguised, because the whole point of her narration is She doesn't know what's going on because she doesn't want to know what's going on. And the job of the subdivision and the judges is to persuade her to come to terms with it. And she's not ready to do it. But the world, which was created for her and by her in a way, mm-hmm. Its job is to show it to her, right? So it mm-hmm. keeps giving her these hints. And it was really fun for me to think about how I could slip this stuff into the novel in a disguised fashion.
I love that.
Alex and I were talking beforehand about how free this book feels, like mm-hmm. in terms of like it follows its own rules. And it seems to correspond with what you're talking about, that you just went for it, you know, and you just had fun.
Yeah. And the another inspiration for it was my friend John is a novelist, and he was describing a book of his that was about to come out. This is Jonathan D. And he said that he was saying, oh, yeah, I'm really excited about this book. I wrote it very quickly. It was like a little wind-up toy. And I just wound it up and put it down and let it go. And I felt this deep envy.
Yes.
And the novel that resulted, his last book, is really good. I recommend it. But I was like, oh, I want a wind-up toy. You know, I want that too. And so this book became my wind-up toy. It wasn't even – there was nothing more specific than that about what he said. But it made me realize, like, it could be small – and it could just march forward.
Yeah.
And a very early attempt at this book had the backstory in it in flashbacks.
Wow. Like,
there were separate chapters where the stuff that happened in the past was in there. And after doing a couple of those chapters, I was like, this is stupid and boring. I don't want to do this. I want to play with my toy.
Yeah.
I think instinct was correct. I feel like that makes the mysteriousness of it makes it more compelling, and it makes it feel more satisfying when you know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think by the end, you have a very good sense of what happened, and it deepens the darkness that's in the book already. And it deepens like the real, you know, the connection to reality.
Yeah.
I want to, like, for a second, just want to acknowledge that, like, it's okay to write a book very quickly sometimes, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, like the trope is, oh, it's taken me years and I edited it and I revised it. And I think sometimes it can just be, it just completely pours out of you, you know, in this one fell swoop.
I agree with you. I mean, of course I do, because that's what happened to me. But other books of mine were not like that. And I feel like this is why most writing advice irritates me, because so much of it is, well, here's how you do it.
Right.
And the rule that has been generated applies only to one book that one person wrote.
Right.
That in their mind is now the solution to writing. Right. But the ways of actually getting yourself to the end of a manuscript and then revising the manuscript are entirely specific to you and the project and your life circumstances, what kind of time you have to do it, and how free your mind can be. So I was in a lucky position. It was the summer, I had a sabbatical coming up, and I actually had some time to ponder. I was living by myself very briefly at this time, and I had very few obligations, and this is a very rare moment in my life that it was like this great open space that I could fill with this thing. And I just did it all day long for 3 months, 4 months.
Wow.
Yeah. I will probably never have an opportunity like that again, but it was really great.
I guess you could have watched like Jerry Springer all day. So you'd capitalized on that opportunity. You'll always have that.
Well, what I was doing the rest of the time, was playing video games, and I think that a lot of the logic of video games made it into the
that's into so the funny that too. you say that, because my son, my 8-year-old, just started playing this Lego video game. It's like mm-hmm. Lego City video game.
Yep.
And as I was watching him play it, I was like, God, I feel like this is like a J. Robert Lennon, like a subdivision type situation, because there's like ambient noise and he's walking around a city and he's trying to like figure out what to do next. And like, sometimes you can break things and then they build themselves back up again.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, did you do this based on a Lego video game?
Not a Lego video game, but one thing I really love is, you know, every sort of open world video game has a map and you can roam all over the map, but the map has an edge. And usually the developers build in a lot of extra land on the other side of the boundary that you can't get to, but they build it there so you can see it. So the world feels infinite, right? Mm-hmm. But when you get to it, there's an invisible wall and something, you stop walking and something appears on the screen. Sometimes it's like, you can't go there or you cannot leave the mappable area, you know? This is the world boundary, or there's a, you know, some bits of Assassin's Creed where there's this crazy, like flashing staticky literal boundary that feels like the end of the world. Hmm. And I find this artifice really delightful, and it's very applicable to literature. You know, a book is very finite. There's a limited number of words in it. It's a self-contained object. It has a beginning and an ending, and you don't see the characters poop. You don't see them eat breakfast.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, I see it. I believe, you know, but there are things that a novel is never going to show you, and it's a convention, right? We're not supposed to think about those things, but I kind of enjoyed in this book the world announcing its limitations. You know, it's no different from a conventional novel, really, except that I kind of enjoyed talking about the boundaries of things, like the road to the city that is blocked, and the, you know, at one point she tries to follow someone off the map, and a catastrophe occurs.
Mm-hmm. How mad were you when WandaVision stole this idea from you?
Ooh, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, never mind.
Right, you've now spoiled it for me. No, we canceled the Disney Plus. My children are grown, there are only so many Disney movies we're gonna watch. So it seemed foolish to keep paying for it. But then as soon as I cancel it, it's like, oh, maybe we should.
Maybe they're gonna bring
watch
you back.
The Parent Trap again. So one of these days we'll hop back on and watch that.
Yeah.
John, when did you know that Let Me Think was going to be released at the same time? What was the impetus for that decision?
I submitted them together to Grey Wolf, assuming that they would put out one immediately and one not immediately, two years later, as they do, and then the other one the following year. And to my surprise, they're like, no, let's do them together. When they first published me, I think in 2009, they published my novel Castle, but they also published Pieces to the Left Hand, which had been published in Britain years before, but had not found a U.S. publisher yet. Hmm. And they decided to bring them out together. And I don't think the sales are like high or anything, but Pieces for the Left Hand sales are consistent. Like, people continue to buy that book and occasionally talk about that book. And I think they were thinking, oh yeah, let's do it again. It's like it's a little more than a decade later. And I've had a bunch of books with Grey Wolf, and they will do that magical thing they did back at the beginning where they published a short novel and a short collection of short stories together as one sort of thing. And that's how that happened. The collection, I had some of that stuff I wrote before I wrote Piece for the Left Hand. Hmm. I wrote a lot of it before I wrote the stories in, not a lot of it, but some of it. The stories in See You in Paradise, which is a collection of like more conventional length and form short stories. But I kind of knew I had all this stuff that had different concerns and was formally odd.
Yeah.
And at some point, it reached a critical mass. It started to generate its own heat, like a mulch pile. And I started dumping more stuff in it. I was like, oh, you know what? This is a book now. I'm gonna start writing to the pile. And over 3 or 4 years, I would dump more stuff in there. The book was originally like twice as long, and I cut half of it. Because some themes were emerging, and a lot of the stuff didn't fit, because much of it was just prompts, experimental prompts I gave myself to you know, break a slump.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, my editor and I did manage to carve something coherent out of it, I think. And I like the book.
Oh yeah, I love this book, and
thank you.
It's one of my favorite collections. Have a quality of just the story to story. There may be groupings, there may be pairings and resonances, but there's also just dissonance and you know, long stories, short stories, all that. I love just a varied collection, and this certainly is one of them. I think most people would expect, you know, okay, I got a story like The Loop, I have a story like Bread Man, and maybe we'll get another 10 more like that, and there's a collection. But the fact that you have, you know, stuff like Monsters and In Darkness in here, I love it. It's a great one. So
thank you.
I'm very glad that it's formed the way it is all I'm trying to say.
I was really inspired by collections like Bartlemy's 40 stories and 60 mm-hmm. stories, or Lydia Davis's books. You know, Lydia Davis is, she's a serious lady. Like,
yeah,
she writes philosophically and intellectually compelling fiction. And then suddenly there's a story that's just a letter to a company that makes frozen peas complaining about the graphic on the bag.
Right.
And I love that. And the sort of freedom that she claims, right, that she insists belongs to her, that she gets to do that.
Yes, totally.
And there's a story in Let Me Think that was I have this assignment that I give my students, which is a lipogram. You know, you leave out the letter E. I always make them write about a funeral, because there's so many things about a funeral that have the letter E in them. And the students have to scramble to think of other ways to say obvious things. They write a little one-page story without the letter E in it. And before my wife and I were married, she challenged me. She was we were apart, and she was at her parents on Passover, and they had this knife, this like, you know, turkey slicing knife that came in its own box, and it had been hanging around the kitchen for 40 years, and it contained this little card that was like an essay contest that you could send into the company. The company has been gone for decades, I'm sure, where you could send in an essay contest showing why you love the knife. And she suggested I write a lipogram about the knife.
Oh yeah, it's in there.
And my editor was like, does this really belong in here, Sean? I was like, you're damn right it does. My turkey knife story is definitely going in.
How do you like decide how to place the stories when you're assembling your, you know, specifically this collection? How did you decide?
This one was actually kind of, most of them, it's just like, most of them it's more, well, okay. So for Peace for the Left Hand, which was 100 very short stories, kind of more monolithic than this collection, I just thrown them in there in a random order. I mean, mm-hmm. I literally randomized them. And I was thinking of Double Nickels on the Dime, the Minutemen album, which is like 50 really short songs, and there's a little note in the liner notes that's like, you should listen to these in a random order. And they actually recommended shuffle on when the CD version came out. And of course my editor was like, no, you can't shuffle a book. You should put these in thematic categories, and then you should write a little introduction to each category. They'll be like chapters. And I was surprised to see that, yes, they did kind of fall into categories. So a similar thing happened with this book. I realized that they corresponded to sort of stages of life, like birth, youth, love, insanity, and death.
Wow.
And I actually had them. They're pretty strictly put into these categories, and I had titles for the sections. And my editor finally was like, "Let's get rid of the section titles and let's just shake it up a little bit. Like it doesn't have to be that way. You're free, right? It will still have the ghost of the categories, but there will be little swerves away from those categories." And that was really satisfying to me. It's like, okay, we're talking about insanity here. We're talking about madness, but here's a little treat, you know, here's a little snack before you go on to the next, you know, bout with mental illness. Or, you know, not everyone has to die in this section. We'll have a fun part. So yeah, that was it's sort of roughly arranged. And then at some point it became like, I got down to once I cut all the stuff I was going to cut, it came down to like, okay, moving to the mood here is too abrupt. And I want to put something in between there that gets you from A to C, right? I want you to put the B in. In other places, I explicitly wanted a jolt. I had the thing that only usually poets get to do, which is printing it all out and putting them all over the floor, you know, and putting them in an order.
The frozen pea story in this collection for me, John, the one that I'm really glad is in there, it made me laugh, was that the marriage point story, the exclamation point story. That's the one when I reached it, I was just like, oh, Jesus Christ. That one made me laugh a lot.
I don't remember how I came up with that couple, but I wrote a couple of them, was like, these people just delight me to no end.
What does it feel like to revisit your older stuff, you know?
One of the really old ones was Cottage on the Hill. Mm-hmm. Which had been published. There was a short-lived magazine called Unstuck. That was great. I think they only put out like 3 issues, maybe.
I don't know.
But they published that, and then Electric Literature did it too, as like a recommended reading. Mm-hmm. And people, that's one of the stories people remembered and asked me about. So I went back to it and I was like, I don't like this. Then I was like, no, I can just edit it. And then I rewrote it. And then I realized, you know what? This story is about going through life. So I can put a part of it in the beginning of the book and a part of it in the middle of the book and a part of it at the end of the middle and a part of it at the end. And suddenly it became like this thread that ran through the entire book. So once I fixed the problems that I saw in the writing, I suddenly liked the way it lived in this collection. So that was the kind of most stuff. It was like, this old thing fits or doesn't fit at the end. But that story was like, this belongs in here in a different form. And I just have to figure out where it goes. When I look back, especially with my short fiction career, the things I'm proudest of is when some weird person just asked me for something and I gave it to them for free, and it ended up being kind of like a legendary thing. You know, I kind of learned this lesson from Steve Dixon, who died a couple years ago, he just wrote a shit ton, and anyone who asked him for a fiction, he would give it to him.
Yeah.
And my ex, Rian Ellis, and I had a magazine together for a few years, and we asked him for something, and he gave it to us, and it was awesome.
Wow.
As I started to publish, I was like, I want that kind of career where I'm not fussy about where I send my stuff and who I'm with on the page, right? Because the people who are like you, obscure, someday will not be, and you won't be either. And it will be this kind of cool thing that you did a long time ago, before you knew it was cool, you know? And I think one of my favorite things about getting older as a writer is having those experiences in my past.
It seems like the situation you have with Grey Wolf now, John, is so well suited to that approach and kind of what you're looking to do in general with your fiction. Could you talk a little bit about maybe what your more early publishing career looked like as opposed to what it is now, and what kind of your situation now allows you to do approach wise?
Yeah. And I like to talk about this. I know, Alex, you have published a couple of books, and you're probably, you know, wondering where your career is going. I think, Lindsay, you've published, what, Flick 4?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. But it sounds like you're looking for a new house, too. It's like I started out, like, I sold my first book to Riverhead when they were a new imprint at Penguin, I guess, or Random House. I don't know. They weren't married yet. Penguin and Random House, but whatever. And they dropped me. Like, my second book, they clearly didn't like, but they published it anyway. And then the third book, they just straight up rejected. They said it was too weird. And then I went to Holt, and then Holt rejected my next book. And then I went to Norton, and Norton bought my next book, but then they dropped it because they were afraid they'd get sued over it. And jeez, they didn't pay me.
Oh my God.
That was when I got the great teaching job I have now. So I got very lucky, but it was a moment where it's like, are you kidding me? Like, like, I can't not get that money. I did the work. Anyway, but, and it was like, I was beginning to feel like this idea of myself as someone who came out of grad school, immediately started publishing, and was doing the, you know, taking my lumps so I could work my way up in the world. I was actually working my way down.
Oh my gosh.
Selling fewer books each time. And these New York commercial publishers would think, oh no, this book's pretty good. Like, the last publisher just did it wrong, you know? But it turns out the problem was me all along. And, and then when I left Norton, and then I lost my agent as well, and ended up hooking up with Jim, and he's the one who said, Jim Ruttman, the agent that Lindsay and I share, he said, I know you would like to get a nice big advance from a big publisher, and you deserve to. However, Grey Wolf Press in Minneapolis is making a big push right now to start publishing more books and making them more prominent. And they have a new national distribution, and they have a good publicity team. And I think we ought to submit this book to them along with your old story collection. And I thought of it as a compromise at the time because they don't give huge advances.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point I had a job and I thought, okay, this is perfectly fine. You know, I'll do this for a little while. And very quickly I realized, like, no, I'll do this as long as possible. I don't ever want to be on the market again. I love these people because they were publishing like 30 books a year. When it was your turn for your book to come out, they gave you their full attention. That everyone there read it.
Wow.
Everyone there liked it. It's like, you call them on the phone and they pick up. You send them an email and they respond. And it's because they are nice people, smart people who like their jobs and have good taste. Mm-hmm. And they want to make sure that your work is as good as it can be.
Wow.
And they actually care about it. And they're not, you know, they're it's not like they have... There was this moment on my first book tour. I met up with my publicist in Portsmouth. Where is that? New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I had been, you know, they put me up in hotels and on the tour. And I was always nervous that I was spending too much money. Like, can I order an appetizer and then charge it to my room, you know? And I was like, I said to him, Michael, like, the hotel I'm in, like, last night, I had two glasses of wine. And is that okay? And he said, John, do you know how much it costs for us to give Tom Clancy a helicopter for the weekend?
What?
We don't care about your glass of wine.
Oh,
I was like, okay.
Oh, waiter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, next round's on him.
Fucking Tom Clancy. Do you think he's available for blurbs?
Well, I think what Tom? I think he's dead. Well, actually, he seems to have kept writing even despite having died. So probably.
Oh, good. Okay, perfect. Yeah. I'm gonna hit him up.
But you know, even though that was really funny, and I was glad to get my glass of wine, it was like, you know, Grey Wolf doesn't have the budget. They sent me on a tour. I'm crashing with friends for the most part and driving a rental car, but it's so much more fun, and I don't worry about disappointing anybody. And then I read in Minneapolis, and all this Grey Wolf staff shows up.
Oh, that's awesome.
They're the best.
One of the best literary cities. The Twin Cities are like just so enthusiastic. Every time I've gone there to read, it's been so fun.
Grey Wolf shares an office space with Milkweed. They share a building. I think they're in the same building. And those people are all really nice too. And they really all feel like there's a local like intense commitment to putting out good books.
That's amazing. And I feel like smaller presses are like you're saying, so much better at like thinking about where to send you and you know, like generating excitement about a potential tour. Whereas I feel like sometimes the bigger houses are like, well, when are you coming to New York? You know, like, wait, you don't live in New York? You know?
Yeah. There is a sense of, I had some good experiences at the bigger publishers. My editor at Henry Holt was especially great. Jim McCray. But there was a sense when you talk to them of like preemptive disappointment. Mm. There was this sense of like, the book's coming out in 3 months. There's no buzz. Like they wouldn't say it, but as you came closer and closer to publication, they would get harder and harder to track down. Oh. And because they knew that a miracle was not about to occur. So they weren't going to put themselves behind it. Whereas I feel like smaller presses, I think Tin House is doing great work in this way too. Mm-hmm. Like no one is assuming a miracle is going to occur. They're going to promote the book and they like doing it because they like the book.
Right.
And it's like something they're all making together.
Right.
Like, I think at a huge publisher, a commercial publisher, your editor likes your book for sure. Your editor's assistant likes your book. Maybe the publicist sort of likes your book or has read the first chapter. The marketing team really wishes that they could just place another full page ad in the New York Times Book Review for whoever, James Patterson, right? It's like, yeah. The editor is the person who's like, yes, I love to acquire these small books to go along with the big things that we published. And once you get to the people who actually need to make the money, they're like, yes, you are a distraction to us. And we really wish you would go away so that we could do the stuff we have to do, you know? And it's really nice to be at a place with high literary expectations and low profit expectations.
Yeah. And I think especially if you're someone who loves to write short stories and, you know, will continue to write short stories, the smaller presses, it seems, are just more open to that.
You do not hear the heavy sighs. It's like, oh, you got a story collection. Great.
Mm. Let's rap about it.
You know, they're all time bestsellers are like Claudia Rankine, right? It's like,
yeah,
short stories are kind of like poems, our bestseller. Oh, we'll publish that.
Ouch.
So John, coming from that kind of trajectory and experience, what do you tell your MFA students as they're graduating? What is the kind of advice to, obviously you can't say, you know, start at a big publisher and eventually work out and find someone great and I hope it works out. What is the advice that is like something that you can actually give your students that is maybe useful?
Yeah,
when he says students, he means me and him.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I'm talking about Lindsay Hunter and Alex Hayes.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm Please always help. Like, around the time you turn 36, you want to have a big legal problem with your publisher where you end up, they will only let you talk to lawyers and you never talk to your editor again. That's what you want.
Perfect. I have 2 years.
I'm really lucky to teach at Cornell, which is a well-heeled institution that is a pleasure to teach at. And because we have a good funding structure, we attract really, really good writers. And so we get to pick people who we can be really proud of when they leave our program. Mm-hmm. The problem is that occasionally some of them do get famous, like No Violet Bulawayo's book sold really well. Tay Abrek's book sold really well. Ling Ma's book sold really mm-hmm. well recently. And so there is a sense, and it's not a crazy fantasy, that maybe I will be the next Cornell student who hits it out of the park,
right,
and has a bestseller that gets made into a movie or a TV series or whatever. And they probably won't be, but you can't tell them that's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And don't, you know, so I feel like I tell a lot of students, like, your career, even if you do well at first, and because everybody loves a first novel, because all of the work is still ahead of you and you haven't disappointed anyone yet. A lot of time when a first novel really hits hard, it's almost impossible for the second one to, because people think that the thing they saw in that book is you, and it's actually just this tiny sliver of you. You have all kinds of obsessions and skills and quirks that are going to emerge over a long career, but you have to commit to having that career. You have mm-hmm. to be willing to keep writing, even when your publisher, who, you know, made you all this money for your first book, rejects your second because it's not commercial enough. Because that's the thing that happens. And, you know, some writers, of course, do have good long careers with big publishers. But, you know, writing is not that lucrative. Mm-hmm. And even for successful writers, it's not that lucrative. Or even if it's temporarily lucrative, it's not going to be in 5 years. You know, mm-hmm. there's just a handful of writers who write the kind of stuff my students do who just have hit after hit. I mean, I haven't had any. You know, mm-hmm. Tay is the closest thing so far. She's got a great career. But also her imagination is really wild, and she's going to do all kinds of different things, and she's not going to write bestseller after bestseller just because the public is fickle and the publishers are fickle. But that's a good thing. You should be attracting different people with every book, even if it's just 10 people, you know?
Right.
I had a book almost nobody of mine has read. On the Night Plane. It came out the first week of September 2001.
Oh my god.
The terrorist attacks happened while I was on a plane.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Heading to my first book tour date.
Oh my god.
Jesus fucking Christ.
And then I got off the plane and I went to the men's room, and then I got an Egg McMuffin, and I came back to the United counter, and all, I don't mean to laugh, but it wasn't funny at the time at all.
Of course not, yeah.
I'd come back to the United counter, and I look up at the board, and the flights just say canceled, 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 canceled. Jeez. And I go to ask them what happened, and they're all crying. And
oh
I
was my like, gosh.
Oh shit, something happened. And the book disappeared, right? And of course, the last thing in the entire world that you can do is complain that your book failed because of the terrorist attack.
Oh my god.
Right? But these, you know, you have all kinds of failures for reasons you can't predict, and your career is not on rails. It's a weird hike through the wilderness, and you have to kind of enjoy having it even when no one is paying attention to you. I feel like the stuff I do where I assume no one's paying attention, and so I have a good time doing it, is often the stuff that people remember, or that becomes successful in some obscure way. And I feel like I'm 50. My career is now starting to feel like it has some richness and depth to it, in that mm-hmm. I've done a lot of different stuff, and it's all out there. It's not famous, like, people aren't necessarily reading it right now, but it exists. And if you like something of mine and you type my name into Google, you'll find a bunch of stuff that's different from the thing you just read. And maybe you'll be stoked about that. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember
I'll
being,
say, yeah. When I told my husband you were coming on, he was like, oh, because
really?
He loved Broken River.
Yeah, he's a big Broken River fan.
Yeah. Oh, great, he was like, great. Wait, what? And he literally just told his mom tonight to go read it. So big J. Robert Lennon fans sweet. In this house.
Thank you. No, I can't thank you enough for that. Mm. But yeah, that's what I tell the students is that you're like, take the long view. And you know, you will have some successes and you'll have some failures, and even the successes might be small, but it's like, you just have to enjoy doing it and look like you enjoy doing it. So people see you enjoying it and they're like, what's that guy doing? That looks interesting. You know?
Yeah. And it can be really hard to remember that it's yours, right? Like it's your career, it's your writing.
Yeah. And I found that students who have early success become very naturally, but in my mind, unwisely concerned about continuing to make a good impression. If you're a good student, you might make a writing career might be hard for you because you're accustomed to pleasing people, mm-hmm. right? Pleasing the authority figures. But in publishing, where money is changing hands, even commercial publishing is full of very smart, cool people who have published great books. So I'm not knocking on them in general. But the bottom line means something, and it gives your editors power or takes away their power, depending on what sales are or what trends are going on. And you can't predict what they're going to like. You can't predict what other people are going to like. All you can do is figure out what you like to do and do it super hard. And the hope is that people will recognize the joy you take in creating it.
Mm-hmm. Well, both these books have that in spades, John. That's kind of what Lindsay and I were talking about before you came on. I mean, Subdivision. I mean, I was telling Lindsay when the courthouse was first described and you see the dead tower, I stopped and I was just like, I bet John fucking had so much fun doing this. Just yes. Like, it's so obvious. I mean, it's there.
You know where that came from? Was when AWP was in Minneapolis, and you know how Minneapolis has all these, or was it AWP? Maybe it was this ABA, some bookseller thing. Anyway, one of the times I was in Minneapolis for some literary thing, a lot of the buildings are connected by these skyways.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I just, was like wandering around through them, trying to find my way across town through the skyways, which is very inconvenient. It's just to keep you warm, but it's actually really confusing if you don't live there. And went to the end of one. It was like, it was blocked off with like a sawhorse, and like beyond there was a construction site, and there's guys in hard hats in there. And I was like, well,
I guess I'll work here.
Guess I'm not. Yeah. I found my new job. So when I was thinking of someplace for the narrative of this book to work, I was remembering this weird sensation of like being in this bustling convention center and then going through this glass tunnel to a wasteland. and you're exactly right, Alex. It's like, yeah, I would work in the wasteland.
Exactly.
Yeah, because then you would stumble upon the guy doing the quantum tunneling. How could you miss that?
That would be my hope, yeah.
I was telling my kids who was going to be on tonight, and my 8-year-old was like, oh, that book, you loved that book. So,
oh, great.
Thank you so much for being on.
Oh,
thank
God, you so my much pleasure, for you guys.
All the advice that you just poured onto us.
Some of it is coming directly from this mustard jar full of whiskey that I've been drinking while I've talked to you.
Well, we receive it even more heartily then.
and as established, we love you. And
we love you too. We meaning me. I call myself we.
You and your whiskey. You and your whiskey love us.
Yeah, you guys are great. I'm delighted to be on one of my favorite literary podcasts. So thank you.
Oh man.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
So much.
That was pretty special.
I feel like I needed to hear everything he said. Like being rejected as much as I have been rejected, it's still different every single time. And it's still like, it's surprising how quickly you can sort of forget your ownership, you know, like you can forget, like I, like we're, I'm, we're going through the submission process right now. I know you know this, Alex, I'm just saying this for our listeners. I had to like, I had to really, cause I'm working on another novel now, or I was. And, so the novel that's out on submission is the one I wrote before. And I had to like, really, like literally I was talking to myself at the playground, trying to remind myself where I came from when I wrote that thing and what I was trying to do there. And because for a few days I had forgotten, because there was, there's been so many like, nah, this is, you know, like, oh, and it's also a mind fuck. Cause you'll hear like, wow, what a brilliant voice. Wow. I love this so much. I related to so much of it. This is so good. It's going to land somewhere, but not for, not with us. And so you tell yourself like, okay, well it, then it will land somewhere, but maybe they're not really like liking it that much. So then like, it's like John was saying, you start to listen to others instead of listening to like, you, you know, anyway, so that's just something that I have to relearn, you know, and like, that's just how it goes as a writer. And before this, before I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to be an actress. So I feel like what is wrong with me that I want rejection so much in my life, but it is, it's just a part of it. I saw the other day on Twitter, a bunch of like well-known writers were talking about how they often get rejected even now. So it happened.
I saw that too. It was like Roxane Gay and who else was talking? Yeah. I can't remember.
Amber Sparks.
Yeah.
And some other people were talking about, oh yeah, I get rejected and it hurts. And, but the one thing that always makes me feel better is writing, is just going back and just doing like writing anything. Because you have to like, remember, you have to remember like who the fuck you are, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you're not going to get rejected.
Get out of here.
I don't want you to worry. I don't want you to worry. Cause I don't.
Well, it's funny because, you know, this, like with a novel and like a normal submission process with an agent, like an agented submission process, I have never gone through that. I have dealt with a ton of rejection for short stories. And like when I teach, the little bit of teaching I've done, one big thing I do is I show my students like my full rejection list for the years 2014 and 2015. And it's like, I think close to 400 submissions over the 2 years for, seriously, for now, that's for like every story that was in Cardinal. And oh, I sent it, I sent each one to maybe like 6 or 7 places. And then some of them I sent more places. And I think out of all those stories, you know, it's not every single one that was in Cardinal, because some of them were published before. I think it's only around like 7 acceptances.
Oh my God.
And the places aren't big, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest place is maybe like, you know, like one of them ended up at Recommended Reading, which was really cool. Or, you know, but like we're talking about places like Pank or like, you know, things like that, like nice online journals, whatever. We're not talking about Granta or the New Yorker or anything. So it's at every level, is all I'm trying to say. And that if you, you know, what John's talking about, what you are going through right now, what I'm about to go through, it's like, it's that every, it's that the stakes change, because obviously when you're sending to online journals, you know, maybe you'll get sent a t-shirt or $20 or nothing, usually nothing. And it feels really different to have 10 friends excited about it, as opposed to like actually making money or, you know, getting a review somewhere huge or whatever. But it's kind of that way the whole way. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, I loved that. I loved what John was saying, was just that he really is kind of on the other side of it. And you and I started this whole like conversation tonight when it was just you and me talking about like the joy we saw in these books, legitimately, that's where we started. And that's really where John came back to, like, hey, I am writing the books I want to write. And
yeah. And it's funny to hear like the hell that he went through on multiple occasions, you know, and like, this is, you know, like my first real hell. because I've been really lucky, you know, previously with the editor that I had at FSG, Emily Bell. So, you know, I'm always treading the line, or whatever, balancing the line of like, you should feel your feelings about this, and the other side of it, which is, well, fucking buck up and just keep working, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I go back and forth, but no, I, one of the things that's been great is these conversations I've been having with my editor, or my agent, and like hearing someone say back to you what you wanted your book to be and what you know your book to be, and like really understanding what it is, and seeing really clearly, you know, its potential. So I'm just like, I feel like that has been a really great aspect of this whole thing. Like, cause you really, you need to be able to talk to these people in your life that are, you know, advocating mm-hmm. for you. And
yeah.
So anyway, so that's been good. We'll see what happens. We'll see.
Good things are going to happen.
I just knocked my fake wood again. I just finished reading Claire Beam's The Illness Lesson.
Oh yeah. 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 I saw you, your tweet about that. I see that. I've been seeing that book everywhere.
Yeah. I had asked on Twitter for recommendations for books about enraged women. This was mm-hmm. even before the rejection started. And that book came up a few times. So I finally, and then I think I saw, Richard Mirabella talking about it, and that put me over the edge. Oh my God. If you haven't read it, you should read it. I
haven't read it. Yeah. I gotta pick it up.
Believe what I was reading. Really, really enjoyed it. That's my book rec for the week.
Awesome.
Are you reading?
I have been reading way less. I stopped with the audiobooks without even thinking about it. Mm. I think because I wasn't listening to enough music and I was feeling crazy.
Yeah.
You know what that's like. Like when you don't, I feel like if I don't listen to enough music, I like feel fucking like a crazy person. Mm-hmm. And so I needed more music in the car. And I've just been reading John's books recently, which I definitely recommend. But yeah, no, I haven't been reading quite as much.
I forgot to congratulate John for knowing the word for literally everything, which I feel like is the highest compliment I can give any writer. I think I've complimented Alyssa Nutting in the same way before.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because he just, everything is so precise. His precision is truly monumental.
Yes, but also you don't get lost in it. I mean, you're just, right. You're with him.
It's not for its own sake. It's not like a, right. You know, a flex or whatever, as they could say.
No, it's not a flex. Oh, fucking John, always flexing.
But yeah, that's man. It.
Yeah, that's it.
Onward and downward.
put that on a shirt. Onward and downward.
I'm a writer, but onward and downward.
There we go. All right, bud. Talk to you.
See you later.
When I talk to you. Bye.
Bye. I'm a Writer Butt is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Because there's a pandemic out there, please wear a mask. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.